Welcome back to Radio Rothbard. Tho Bishop here, back with Ryan McMakin. And we got a lot of news headlines out there that I think need some, if you don't laugh, you're going to cry, including some new inflation numbers. We have, we've got the Republicans who have now going out there on a daily basis, decrying Bidenflation, voting alongside the rest of the Uniparty with $40 billion more to Ukraine. And a few other moments like that. Ryan, how are you doing?
I'm pretty good. There's been plenty to talk about the last couple of weeks, so that's made things a little bit easier, right? Last week, we had the Fed with their new FOMC meeting. This week, it's the inflation numbers. And it's mostly been bad news, either bad economic news or just bad news in that you realize that the people who are supposed to prevent disaster on these fronts clearly have no idea what they're doing.
Well, that is the one advantage of clown world, is that while civilization crumbles around us, at least there's plenty to be distracted with for both better and for worse. It's very interesting now, like the fact that you see a little bit of rejoicing of a slightly declined inflation number. It's still above 8%, typically not what you want. But I even saw some people spiking the football on the fact that used car prices are going down. And this is supposed to be some sort of signal that, aha, inflation really has been transitory this entire time. We are turning the corner. And therefore, I think the implication is, by the time that midterms or, politically relevant times come around, that Biden recovery is going to look just swell. And of course, this is one of the problems when you're highlighting individual asset groups as you're trying to extrapolate the inflationary moment from very specific sort of nitpicked little data items here. It is very interesting to see the type of economic commentary out there with so much focus on monetary items.
Yeah, this is a new thing for everybody in that you can now get a glimpse of all of this chatter over the economy over Twitter. We didn't have much social media in the same way back in 2008 when that financial crisis was unfolding. Although there were definitely sources for minute-to-minute sorts of narratives on the crash then. But boy, yeah, it is fun and interesting to watch the contrast between the bulls and the bears in social media. And yes, watching the predictions for what was the inflation number going to be on Wednesday. And so everybody's putting out their pieces on Tuesday about that. And we were supposed to be really happy that we turned the corner and inflation had peaked. And this time it was going to be 7.9% or 8.1%, actually ended up coming in even higher than that, at I believe 8.3. And that's quite remarkable that that's something we're supposed to be happy about. But you look at how this has been building, right? This has been going on since the third quarter of last calendar year, with mounting inflation, 5%, 6%, 7%, 8%, all on top of the previous base. And you're never going to get that purchasing power back because, and this is something Jim Grant would always point out, right? They're not going to let deflation happen. So you know that anything you lost due to inflation, that's just gone. It's your dollar's just devalued permanently. It's not going to regain some of that purchasing power. And so this just builds on what came before. And then you add all that up with the 2%, the 3% per year for more than a decade before that. And it's really quite astounding on what has happened just in the last 2 years. If you had $1,000 stashed somewhere, well, now you basically have $900. And I mean, that's quite remarkable on how little time has gone by and you're losing 10% of your value. And there's just not a whole lot to rejoice about in other places. You can say, well, I maintained all my value because I put my money in the stock market. Well, you just lost probably everything you had from the previous calendar year over that. Not year to date, but like this time last year. And so anything that's tied really to these flows of speculator cash, which of course is itself tied to feelings about how easy is the Fed going to be. I mean, a lot of this stuff is just looking pretty grim right now.
Of course, even if you look at gold markets, again, 8% inflation reported, you know, official numbers, whatever, that's a whole other topic. And yet the price of gold goes down on the news. Now I think it's almost, I think, about $200 off of its peak at March when people really were certain to realize just how bad this monetary situation is going in. But this is kind of one of those problems, though, right? Is that, but now that we actually have the Fed, you know, and I think both of us still have very skeptical positions about the long term. Again, I don't know if any of us are placing any bets on the Fed actually making, you know, 3% interest federal funds rate or some of the stuff as they're being projecting, right? You know, new headlines out this week about how, oh no, you know, 0.75% rate increase is still on the table, maybe down the road. They're not ruling it out entirely, yada, yada. Again, still, I'll believe it when I see it on that regard. But it is this interesting dynamic with as bad as the inflation issue is within the U.S., you know, the dollar is relative to not just American assets, but internationally looking relatively better. And this is kind of some of the intricacies, right? You know, the differences between asset price inflation and consumer price inflation, the degree to which asset price bubbles were being inflated sort of pre-COVID as a result of monetary policy, the consumer price inflation post-COVID, and particularly with, you know, the U.S. government creating all sorts of fun new ways to get money out there to the people, getting us a lot closer there to something resembling a helicopter money in the truest sense, that, you know, it's one of those dynamics where there's a lot of confusion out there. And I think it is interesting the fact that, again, as you mentioned, the way social media is out there now within this environment. You know, back in the day, you know, it was like blog comment sections, and perhaps the very nice rest in peace the Mises Institute forums back in the day. You know, the fact that you no longer have those echo chambers of, like, you know, wonky econ blogs, but kind of this broad marketplace having these sort of conversations. It is interesting to see what people are focusing on.
Yeah, well, there's so many different narratives right now. Again, it kind of depends on who you're looking at, which subgroup of Twitter, right? Are you looking at financial Twitter? Are you looking at geopolitics Twitter? Are you looking at just domestic politics Twitter? And then you could have different spins on all of those, right? And so on the geopolitics side, right, we've noted this for a long time. Here at Mises.org, which is that no matter how inflationary the Fed is, it looks restrained compared to other central banks. And so the Fed actually looks like the adult in the room, a very immature adult, one with very high time preference, one that's very bad at running his own life. But compared to the other people, like the European Central Bank, he seems relatively mature, this Federal Reserve guy does. And that's pretty embarrassing, really, that's all it takes. Talk about a low bar. But looking out there, looking at what China's doing, that the yen with the ECB, it's just the dollar comes out looking great. And because the dollar, amazingly, what the Fed is doing seems somewhat hawkish compared to what the ECB is doing, which is just astounding. And just look at what the Fed has actually done in terms of its policy response. Virtually nothing. I've been beating this drum at Mises.org for a while, which is that, look, yep, the Fed has been talking hawkish since late last year, but everything was always in the future. It was, oh, yep, we're going to start talking about raising interest rates. We're going to start talking about ending quantitative easing, that is, ending new purchases for the portfolio, for the Fed's assets. And that took months to do, and they only finally then started winding down this year in real terms with the portfolio in 2022's calendar year. And now here we are in May, and they're saying, well, we won't start reducing the assets until June. Assuming everything goes as planned, we can start clawing back the assets in June. And yeah, we'll raise the target federal funds rate by 50 basis points now, but that's still, you're still just teeny tiny interest rates, even with that, because, ooh, wow, it's been raised a whole 0.75% in recent months. And when you're at basically zero for years at a time, that just doesn't mean anything. And so what we have here is a Fed that's saying it's going to do all this stuff, but it would be absolutely absurd to compare this Fed to a Fed that actually is concerned about inflation, like the Volcker Fed, or maybe earlier Feds like William McChesney Martin, who, well, he didn't, he was like more proactive type of guy, always taking the punch bowl away before the party got out of hand. And so these guys were just, there's no comparison with those people in Powell, Bernanke, Yellen, who never met an inflationary policy they didn't like. And so here we are. That's been all going on since 2009. And the Fed seems to think or would have us believe that just these tiny little increases in the target rate and a little bit of talk here and there about clawing back, winding down the assets, I mean, who would be surprised that inflation is still above 8%? So it's really quite remarkable, but apparently it's the inflation has been enough to tank the markets, it looks like. And it doesn't look like the Fed is really behind much of that at all.
Well, I was particularly amused by, I have a far greater appreciation for some of the more lower key personalities in the Fed after that episode we did a couple of weeks ago, kind of breaking down some of the past statements of these individuals. One, though, the head of the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland, Mrs. Mester, she had a comment yesterday that kind of raised my eyebrow, talking about how the Federal Reserve shouldn't try to support the housing market by holding mortgage-backed securities. And it's like, well, you know, I think that the time for that sort of sentiment might have been a decade ago. I'm not exactly sure what I don't know how. Imagine the political whirlwinds that are going to happen if you start trying to get a normalization of the Fed, like massive selling of mortgage-backed securities when it's the largest holder of these assets in the world right now in terms of American mortgages. I mean, it's just, you know, the rhetoric here is so disconnected from political reality. And what's interesting is that right now there is on the Democratic side in particular, it seems clear that the Biden administration is taking a very pro technocratic stance here, and they're being very deferential to the decisions of the Powell Fed. That fits in part with his decision to renominate Jay Powell, who was, of course, put in this position by Donald Trump prior to him, but was an Obama-era appointee before that still, which again goes back to that the uniparty narrative there. I'm just interested to see how long that patience lasts, because if the Fed actually let's pretend that Jay Powell and the rest of the Fed really has discovered a willingness to find its own Volcker moment, the second that these politicians recognize what that actually means and then the actual impacts of these things, I mean, you know, we see it playing out. I mean, tech stocks in particular. I mean, there's all these asset classes that, you know, you have Americans not only seeing the price at the pump, at the gas station, you know, from those sort of pure kitchen table issues, but, you know, 401ks, the consequences that you're going to end up seeing in insurance funds and pension funds, you know, all of these institutions that our monetary policy has incentivized and required for them to load up on other financial assets because they could not get the return they needed for more conservative ones. Again, those shock waves are something that still I don't think really has is being accounted for in the political calculation here. And I'm just waiting for that moment when Democrats really decide to bring out the knives for Jay Powell and try to figure out how to pivot towards a more looser, a dovish attempt here, because I don't see how they can ride this out the way it's going.
Yeah, I think the way that manifests itself is it shows up in how just delusional the private sector is about values and demand, so that you have all these people in the real estate industry talking about, you know, the fundamentals are sound, everything's fine, there's no reason to expect prices to ever go down. Well, I mean, they always need to include a caveat in there. As long as the Fed keeps artificially pumping demand, as long as government policy subsidizes real estate, as it's doing through secondary market buyers like Fannie and through purchasers of mortgage-backed securities like the Fed, yeah, of course, you shouldn't be shocked when you see home prices like they were in the Case-Shiller data from recent months, up at 20% year over year. And then these private sector people look at that and they're like, yep, housing's strong, the market's strong. They have no idea what anything's worth in a real marketplace. All of this just reflects government meddling 24/7 and a outsized majority of mortgages and financing in the real estate sector has dealings with Fannie and with government agencies of various types, which are really what's pushing that demand there. And so, as you say, right, if you really want to see those numbers tumble, if you want to see the bottom fall out of that industry, just start getting the Fed to start selling off some of those assets. And then we'll find out what the real demand is for it. And then we'll find out if assets are really going to be up 20% year over year consistently. I would guess not, when there's not a huge institution artificially inserting itself into the market to make that happen. And then, of course, that would be disastrous for the banks then, who are still holding a lot of real estate. And so to sit back and say, yeah, you know, market fundamentals are fine, there aren't any market fundamentals. Everything is so influenced by government policy now, by easy money. And I'm not even old enough to remember a time when that wasn't heavily the deal. I was a working professional type of guy back after 9/11, so we're talking 2003. This is when the bubble really started to blow up as a result of Greenspan's policies back then. And so we kind of knew there was something weird going on then. But just imagine if you've got some finance guy, some financial planner trying to tell you about how the fundamentals are strong and the market does this and that, and the guy doesn't have any particular background, and he's not old enough to remember because he's 30 years old. He can't remember a time when everything wasn't a product of government intervention in the marketplace. And so we've got a whole generation of people working in the financial sector coming up for who the norm is central banks propping up values on everything. So it's hard to imagine a world where that's not going to be the case. And I don't know what the Fed is going to do. Maybe there's going to monetize that debt forever, and they're never going to let it go away. And so we'll never really get a sense of what markets are worth until some horrible catastrophe happens, which I don't think is going to happen this cycle. But I mean, sure, are they just going to keep buying stuff then? Or are they just going to sit on that $8 trillion forever and then just let the economy grow for the next 20 years? But the way the economy's going, it's going to take a long time to grow out of that. I mean, that was always the mantra 15 years ago was, it's okay, we'll just keep adding to the national debt in huge intervals, and we'll just grow our way out of it. Well, the problem was the growth got really, really lackluster, and you ended up with ordinary people getting poorer. And so it seems that the growth model really isn't quite delivering as they hoped it would. And all that's really happened is that it's been just funneling wealth to the already wealthy. And a lot of regular people are falling behind. And we saw that in the data here, just this latest data, right? With inflation at 8.2%, but with hourly earnings at 5.4% up year over year. Again, another negative gap, a gap of 2.8%. And that's the 13th month in a row where inflation's been higher than earnings for regular people on an hourly basis. And so you're just looking at that and all of this talk about how everything's fine and growth is coming back any day now. How long is it going to take a regular person to recover from 13 months of losses? Not to mention the fact that it'll probably just flatline here for a number of months after this. Maybe there's a recession on the way. I mean, it's just listening to these people who work on Wall Street or their pundits, and they're all making 100% more than the median household income. It just strikes me as a little bit silly. I mean, it's like some sort of Jim Cramer disease or something. I don't know where we're just extremely sure about how everything's fine, and then it just turns out that it's not fine.
Well, the Republicans do have a good solution here for all of us plebs. You know, if you want to survive this area of financial insecurity, there's a very easy and obvious answer here. You should be loading up on military industrial complex stock. Now, if you are holding on to Northrop Grumman, you're up 20% over the past year. If you're at own Raytheon, you're up about 8%, not quite as good, but you know, it's still in the green relative up more than most. And of course, we just keep seeing the pipeline as all of these concerns going on in the U.S. You know, all the Republicans stopped complaining about Biden inflation to give the Biden administration yet another gift in terms of funding to the Ukrainian war effort, another $40 billion. We're at over. I think this is what, the third, fourth, fifth round of military aid just in the last few months. Also some warnings about we've gone through, I think, 7 years worth of Javelin missiles in the last few months, which again is going to end up perhaps benefiting some of the aforementioned stocks out there if you're in the weapons game. But this is just another highlight. Now it is interesting. It is worth pointing out that I think it was 57 members of the Republican side that voted against this bill, which I think is much higher than past votes on Ukraine aid, sort of broadly defined. Do not think there's been an increase in accountability going on there. And of course, if there was one lesson that should have been learned from the Afghanistan disaster, and all of the reports that came out about the ghost armies, and if they say nothing about all of the weaponry and equipment left behind, is that perhaps there should be a little bit of strings attached to these great deals that we're making. It was interesting. I saw Dan Crenshaw boasting about how you have conservatives complaining about us spending $40 billion on this bill, but it sounds like a great deal if we're providing money to decimate an enemy. And a member of Congress pretty much openly admitting to, what's long been obvious, but that we're actively engaged now in a proxy war against Russia, a nuclear power. So perhaps there's a little bit of momentum from that sort of, within the kind of the populist right, but still the Uniparty strikes again, another $40 billion going to Ukraine. It's just interesting to see how shameless you can still have these rhetorical concerns about inflation and spending coming from these Republican politicians that will then go ahead and give Biden whatever check he wants for as long as it goes to Ukraine and not some domestic aims.
Yeah, Crenshaw's the new John McCain, I guess. And so everything he says is just worse than the last thing he said. And yeah, fortunately, he's balanced out by some more sane Republicans. But you and I aren't naive, right? We're well aware of how spending occurs under both parties. And a couple of years ago, of course, I was complaining about the deficits under Trump, right? It was 2019. We were looking at near $1 trillion deficits then under Republican control. And it was really quite remarkable that sort of spending was taking place during a economic boom and sort of quasi-peacetime, right, where at least no new wars had recently been launched. And they were still spending that kind of money. And I wondered, right, well, what's going to happen when you actually have an economic problem? And I guess we found out, right, we're looking at $3-4 trillion deficits. And that's a really huge factor behind all the monetary inflation, the money creation, because you have to create money to keep interest rates low so that the Fed's debt service doesn't run out of control and you end up with some sort of sovereign debt crisis. As long as the dollar's perched atop these other currencies, you can just keep inflating it, keep your interest rates low, and that's not going to eat up then the rest of your federal budget. And that puts all that deficit spending puts a huge amount of pressure then on the Fed to keep interest rates low. And that's a big reason, I think, that the Fed hasn't been willing to really do much of anything at all. And this is a bipartisan effort, right? This is not something that's going to be fixed because you get rid of Biden, especially on foreign policy stuff. We can expect to see just huge budgets, $900 billion budgets are coming our way for the Pentagon, even in peacetime when this whole Russia thing's over. We're going to be looking at $1 trillion a year budgets for the Pentagon. That doesn't even include all of the nuke money, the Veterans Administration. I mean, that's just going to be runaway money. And then, of course, nobody's going to do anything about Social Security or anything like that. So that spending's just going to continue to spread like wildfire, and neither party's going to do anything to really rein it in. And the deficit spending is just going to be huge. And I think the only thing that will impose discipline on that is when interest rates really have to start going up, because the dollar reaches its limit in terms of what you can print of new dollars without it outstripping global demand. But global demand continues to be strong because all the other currencies look relatively bad by comparison. So it looks like there's not going to be anything to impose any real discipline on that coming anytime soon, except maybe domestically, because the domestic population might be just so overwhelmed by 6-8% inflation rates for a long period of time that they're going to really demand that something happen. But how that manifests itself and whether they just stick a Band-Aid on it to make it look like they're doing something about inflation, because that's certainly been the Fed's tack so far, is just make it look like we're doing something about inflation. And maybe we can just tank the market without actually even doing anything by simply scaring investors by talking tough. And so I just don't know what's going to happen at this point.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was looking at some of the Congressional Budget Office projections on the cost of on debt payments on interest payments on the debt, and some of their projections being baked in with having a lot more of this aggressive rhetoric, and to be fair, being backed up with a Fed policy to date, right? Again, you know, perhaps Powell, the Powell Fed will surprise, but yeah, they're saying, you know, back then that if this was from a February report, that, you know, if interest rates were a full percentage point higher than they're projecting, the increase that it would have over like a 10-year period, which they're estimating, the interest payments would be $7.3 trillion over that period, significantly higher than what they're already projecting within their estimations. And we're already there. They weren't projecting any of these sort of rate hikes at all back in February. And it's going to be interesting to see where the rubber meets the road here, when spending once again becomes an issue. I have no doubt you're going to see a lot of superficial, you know, Tea Party style rhetoric from the same people that have been, completely inept, and in many cases, you know, some of the worst offenders of this sort of stuff. But the other side of it, though, is that, you know, I'm interested to see, you know, what ends up being the global play here. Because again, like the ECB, as I've already mentioned, they have their own problems. There have been conversations in the past. James Rickards has talked about the role that the IMF could play in some sort of global reset. There's been using special drawing rights. There have been open discussions from various, you know, IMF leaders about the role of potential digital currencies and the like. You know, it's interesting because I feel like while none of those, you know, multinational institutions were ever particularly well loved by the public as a whole, right? Not a lot of people out there cheering on the IMF team at the Olympics or waving banners for Christine Lagarde. I feel like after COVID in particular, and given a lot of just the gradual paranoia, I think well-founded, but you know, it almost has a paranoia sort of aspect about, you know, we talked in the past about, you know, the kind of recognition that the billionaire class, you know, right, it doesn't have the public's interest at heart, that the bureaucrats that empower these sort of institutions do not have some sort of access to some sort of specialized knowledge that blundering politicians are creating an issue to. You know, it's going to be interesting to see you know, what, you know, for all of the failures of these national regimes, you know, I don't see a lot of interest in, you know, a globalist institution having this sort of legitimacy now. And thankfully, so. I mean, this I think is perhaps one of those silver linings that there's been a gradual distrust of centralization after several generations that trended towards it with the EU and you know all these various projects. And so that's another aspect here where you know if you get a Fed that is willing to, you know, have the pain that would come from a Volcker moment, and perhaps have a lot, and has the potential perhaps to have more courage than the ECB and some of these other actors. You know, that dynamic here, you know, creates, I think, some different environments that us as, you know, I think this has often been a blind spot of American Fed skeptics, is that, you know, we can be overly, you know, we can be very premature in burying the dollar, given the quality of these other competitors out there. And that's another dynamic where, you know, given everything that we've seen played out, the failure, distrust of these institutions, you know, the transition out of here, I think, there's not an obvious for any of the projects that may have been coming along because of the awakening and the concerns about what the dollar was happening on an international level. I think some of those projects may be creating their own issues. But again, it's going to be interesting to see when the Fed really hits that ceiling on what is politically permissible with any sort of normalization.
Yeah, I mean, putting your faith in people like Mario Draghi or Christine Lagarde, because, you know, they're so much more intelligent and sophisticated than Jerome Powell is, right? They're European. They must be smart, right? Because, you know, Europe filled with geniuses who tried to blow up their continent twice in a single century. And I mean, there's no reason to believe why that would be the case. And that's pretty depressing, though, when you think about the quality of Jerome Powell, right? I watched last week the entirety of his press conference after he, you know, he gets up there and reads the FOMC statement, and then the reporters ask him questions. And they were actually pretty good reporters asking pretty good questions. Things like, well, what would you say is a neutral rate now? Jerome Powell has no idea, refuses to answer the question. They ask him, at what point will people, households, regular people, start to feel some relief from inflation due to your policy changes? Refuses to answer the question. Talks about how there's just going to have to be some pain before we bring inflation back down, you know, just the generic stock responses and stuff. These are supposed to be the super geniuses who have all the special economic knowledge. They're the technocrats. And they've got nothing. There's nothing going for them that isn't going for the marketplace. And so it's just amazing to watch just these people prove wrong again and again, this idea that the central planners, like the central bank, has somehow a better idea of what to do with capital and wealth and the currency than the marketplace could do. And boy, it's just being demonstrated now daily that these people are way behind the curve, and they don't have a plan for what to do next.
Well, and that's one of the things that I think is interesting. I had an article last week about some of the moves from El Salvador the Central African Republic. You know, there's been a little gloating in financial press right now because Bitcoin's price has you know, had a pretty severe downward turn because of some issues with stable coins and exchanges and things like that, neither here nor there. Except always a good reminder to you know, don't trust exchanges with your Bitcoin. But you know, it is interesting, and this kind of parallels with previous question, is that, you know, kind of the frontier of sort of globalist resistance or kind of the ultimate act of rebellion as a nation now, it is on the monetary side of things. And one of the things I thought was interesting is that in the case of both El Salvador accepting Bitcoin as a legal tender, and there are very valid concerns and criticisms of some of the specifics of that proposal, neither here nor there. but also with the Central African Republic's move to liberalize their policies and to accept Bitcoin as a legal tender, both of them were driven not by some sort of closet Hayekian that had become taken over the central bank. Both of them were political moves made by the head of state. In the case of the Central African Republic, I think he had an assistant that was very big on this, but still in both cases. What you had was that it's politicians elected kind of using that expert class a little bit as a foil, not necessarily internally, but broadly. And the other side of that was the IMF engaging in with Argentina providing some sort of financial aid there for some of their issues. Seems like their once a decade financial crisis that Argentina usually has is, and the IMF is explicitly requiring in their agreements there for hostile crackdowns on Bitcoin. But just this dynamic where it's elected officials with kind of their own sort of incentive structures there, both better and for worse, right? The same, a similar incentive structure that incentivizes politicians to not get serious in the U.S. Over cutting spending and anything like that might be unpopular and get the masses mad at them. Here, they're able to kind of use the foil of these Western leaders, ripping them off and all the good, accurate populist rhetoric there. I think that this is a dynamic where, again, seeing the different structures of these institutions at play within this sort of broader environment of economic instability, that's one of those things where it's going to be interesting to see, how many, and obviously we've seen the gold aspect play out a little bit with Russia and some of that aspect as well, Iran and North Korea in the past. If America is targeting you, gold is tends to be one of your moves. But again, it's just gonna be interesting to see, what are the other frontiers here? Because as we were talking about and mocking the delusional sense of importance that Europe has for itself and that American pundits can sometimes give to the continent as well, I think there's a lot more interesting stuff going on in South America and some of these developing nations that might end up being on kind of that frontier there, not wanting to follow sort of that bureaucratic, failing model of that the ECB EU style of things.
Yeah, that will be interesting to see how they're trying to break out from the cycle of debt, right? And Rothbard talked about this a bit on this cycle where you have organizations like the IMF loan your country money, and then they demand you make internal reforms. And in many ways, they're essentially taking over your domestic policies in some ways. And that fuels actually a lot of resentment toward the so-called neoliberals who are believed to be running these organizations, and they're mixed in there with true laissez-faire people and so on. It's a very vague term, but I think that's a lot of what's behind it, is that, we can free ourselves from the neoliberal domination if we can find some sort of money beyond their control, because that's what the dollar is. The dollar basically is the global currency. It just dominates all other currencies so much. And so much lending and borrowing is done in dollars. And if you can somehow escape from that, I could see why a regime would want to do that very, very badly. The question is like real estate, I don't know how much of the crypto price is being influenced by easy money, right? Because there's a slice of that market that's just your speculators who are there just trying to park money somewhere. And that's why you see the price going down at the same time that, say, tech is going down. And these other places where speculators put their money just looking for any sort of return, maybe an inflation hedge or whatever. And so it's hard then to pull out how much of the price is that and how much of it is this different demand that's based more on geopolitical or ideological factors. And I don't know the answer to that question, but maybe the more money empties out of that, you get closer to a real reflection of what the current market demand is, and then you would see different behavior. But I have no idea how long it's going to take for that to work out. And I suppose you would still have people chasing yield and just finding whatever odd place they could stick their money until you start to get more reasonable interest rates that aren't basically zero, so you can get some yields in normal conservative type investments. And we are starting to see that go back up, right? 30-year fixed mortgages, those rates are going back up to basically 10-year highs. And the same way with the 10-year bond hanging out around 3%. If it gets much higher, it's going to be, you're going to be looking at, right, 2010, 2011 type rates again. But, you know, if there's anything the market's been doing, it's it's that the whatever trend's going on right now, I don't know what's going to happen next. And of course, that's always often the case. But I just like to be a little bit reserved on what I say is going to happen in the near term, because I don't know when some new factor could occur. But I think at this point, I think we've milked all there is to milk from blaming Putin for disrupting the global economy or blaming COVID. Clearly, things are proceeding apace in spite of that. And apparently, most of the world, including Europe, is figuring out ways to get around the U.S. effort to isolate Russia. So that will certainly be a factor, but it's not, that by itself is not going to implode the global economy. Neither is China, most likely. The world's a big place, and people are finding other places to put their money. But it certainly is going to impoverish a lot of people who are already near the lower end of the economic spectrum, the economic ladder. And those people are going to suffer the most. And here in America, it's going to be regular people, especially maybe retired people on fixed incomes. And it's just going to be regular working people who suffer the most. The people who have, who can afford a hedge fund, they're probably going to be able to roll with it pretty well. But this is one thing I will agree with Jerome Powell on. If you're going to really finally get markets back to something that reflects reality and brings inflation under control, there is going to be real pain in the meantime.
Well, I'm just thankful that my portfolio is not heavily invested in bored ape NFTs, since that is yet another one of those bubbles that is busting right now. I was luckily outbid before the $406,000 investment in a rather nice looking ape cartoon. Yet another example of some of the hysteria that we saw in some financial markets last year. And we will be tracking that very important story and others here on Radio Rothbard. For Ryan McMakin, this has been Tho Bishop. Until next time.